I did want to get us into our topic, and if you're new to the class, what always we try to do is go through some of the material the church is recommending, and right now we're in the book of Joshua, so turn with me, if you would, to Joshua 2, and as in this case, we'll spend most of our time there and then look at some application points and some questions, and I think you'll learn a little bit more about what the city and the fortress of Jericho looks like. I'm going to show some slides up there, so if they aren't as easy to see up there, they'll certainly be available on the website, or you can even load them up right now on your tablet or smartphone so that you'll see some of that. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a tour of Jericho as we go through this as well. But the focus here is really very simple. If I can summarize what we'll do in the next approximately 40 minutes, we're going to look at Joshua sending two spies into the land of Canaan in preparation for this invasion. And they are discovered and then, of course, find refuge in the home of Rahab, a prostitute. She saves their lives, and they reciprocate by pledging that they will spare her and her family if they stay inside this house and have a scarlet cord out there. And then they come back to Joshua, report that God has given them to their hands. And so we're going to focus a little bit of time and attention here then on the first 11 verses. So if you have a Bible, either in the pew or that you brought with you, let's, if we can, focus on the first 11 verses. And Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. And it was told to the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, "True, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at night, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of flax that she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fjords, and then a gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Shon and Og, where indeed whom have devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God of the heavens above and on the earth beneath." And so here we have a couple of things, as you can see in your handout. Kind of, first of all, this undercover assignment. If you're trying to get a handle on this, you have the Jordan River, and then about 14 miles to the east there is Jericho, and it is a walled fortress. I'll show you what it looks like in just a minute because of the archaeological investigation. We have a pretty good idea of how it looked and where all the various buildings were located at that time. Notice, as I put on the screen here, he put out spies, but they weren't here to decide if they were going to attack, but instead they were simply sent out to get information. And this is put in the context of the book of Numbers, which if you want to go back and read in Numbers 13, this is where before they had sent out 12 of the spies, and 10 of them came back saying, "No mas, don't go. This is not going to work." As a matter of fact, they said that the Israelites are as weak as grasshoppers before the inhabitants. But there were two spies that disagreed with that. Of course, one of them was Joshua, who says, you know, he did not accept that particular opinion. And so they made the mistake, really, of comparing their military strength. And we're talking about probably 2 million people that are going to, as we're going to see next week, crossing the Jordan. Jordan River, and that's going to be in a very significant feat as well, to the military prowess of the Canaanites. And of course, Joshua, as I posted here, understood that the Canaanites weren't going to be fighting Israel. The Canaanites would be fighting God. And he says, even in Numbers 14, you might want to look that up this week if you have a quiet time. Take a time to go into Numbers 14. It's not exactly your typical morning devotional kind of place, but it would be a good place for you to read. It says, their protection is removed for them, and the Lord is with us. So in this particular case, notice what Joshua does. He actually just sends out two spies. It is at least possible, and some commentators have suggested, that because he did that, maybe the Israelites didn't even know that he sent them out. He has certainly had people said, we support you, but he also recognizes how very quickly fear or intimidation or maybe some kind of rumor could get spread and it would lose the resolve that we talked about last time. So again, they search out the land, but they go and spend a special attention to what is at Jericho. Now, it always is interesting because people say, why Rahab? Well, there may be some really good reasons, and I put those on the screen. First of all, to be perfectly blunt, if you're a prostitute, there's probably a lot of people coming and going, right? And so it's a little easier, perhaps, to have been able to get lost in the shuffle of the crowd. The most dangerous place, as we're going to see in just a minute, was where the palace was located or where the storehouse was located. And as we also learn in just a minute, Rahab's house is actually on the wall, so it was very easy later on for her to let them out of the window and down into the valley and then eventually make their way to the caves, which we'll talk about in just a minute. So that is part of it. But also I think there's a great illustration, if nothing else, and that is the possibility that God can use even common people, somebody like Rahab the prostitute, Rahab the harlot. Let's look at the pictures. This one comes from Logos Software, and so I'll show you it in a diagrammatic way for just a minute. And then we'll look at one from the archaeological investigations. But what you will see here is, first of all, going to this, there is a ditch that surrounds all of this city of Jericho, this fortress. Now, during the rainy season, which is when this was, by the way, because we learn this as we go into chapter 3, that ditch was probably filled with water, so it's sort of like a moat. But even if it's not filled with water, it's filled with a lot of other things. Now, need I explain more? I mean, if you have certain kinds of garbage, certain kinds of human whatever, you know what goes over the wall, right? So this already becomes somewhat impenetrable, but then there is a very steep slope up to just the first outer wall. So if you are going to try to fight, you have to fight your way up to even getting to that first wall, not unlike for those of you that have ever been, say, to Edinburgh, Scotland. If you've ever seen that fortress, it is impenetrable because, you know, they could just continually shoot down on people before they even make it to the wall. So this is the first part. Then the wall that goes around it is the outer wall. This is where we most likely believe that Rahab's house was located. Up in the upper left-hand corner there is the ramparts, which you could walk on. Remember the ramparts, red glare, and the bombs bursting in air? Okay, well, it's the ramparts where you're walking. For those of you that have ever been to Israel, or some of you are going to go with us later, we get to walk on the ramparts of the wall of Jerusalem if you want to. Now, if you don't like heights, you probably don't want to do it. But, you know, that, again, is a place where you could have all the troops. So even if you could make it that far, then now you're faced with something else. You have a second wall there as well. Do you see how almost impenetrable it was? You have to cross a ditch. You have to fight your way up a slope. You have to somehow make your way over that first wall. You have to fight all the way across the ramparts and then make it to the next wall before you even get to where the fortress is, which is also located as well. As a matter of fact, let's go to that next picture because now this will give you a little better idea of, we know almost where every one of those houses are because of the archaeological investigation. So you can see that you got that wall. And then even if you're in there, most of the troops are in a fortress within 1, 2, 3 walls and all of the rest. So you can see how if you did not come to the conclusion that God was going to bring the victory, You can see why this was such a difficult military obstacle. And of course, since it's at the very beginning, this is the one that would, in a sense, protect many of the other cities that they're going to take. So now, if nothing else, you can understand a little bit why some of the spies, especially looking at it from a human perspective, 10 of the 12 go, we are really outmanned. They have great military. They have great positions in high places. They have fortified walls. This is an incredible challenge that they are facing right now. And so, in the sense, of course, we also see in the midst of this how Rahab becomes a principal character. You know, the scriptures are not shy, as I point out here, about pointing out that she was a prostitute and not exactly somebody who would be a strong candidate for God to use. But yet, nevertheless, that is the case. And I think it also really demonstrates the province of God. As we're going to talk about today, one of the themes that comes out of this is that sometimes you see some of these great heroes of the faith in Hebrews 11, you go, you know, it's hard for me to really relate to Moses and Abraham or Enoch or even David. But I can probably relate pretty well to Rahab. You know, God can use common people, and here she becomes a convert, and that is certainly very significant. And in some case, somehow the king is alerted to the presence. Now, as you saw the picture just a minute ago, you can see how word spreads from house to house. So you can see very quickly, it's not like they wouldn't cause a stir as they come in through the gates. And by the way, you come into the gate there on the left there, so you even have to go up a ramp to get into past that first gate. Everybody comes in and out of there. So it was pretty easy to spot some individual. They're trying to mix with the crowd, but nevertheless, it was found out pretty quickly that indeed that is the case. The king is alerted. Now he is wanting to go and find those two spies. And so once the soldiers had gone, then we have her providing this unique perspective. She, of course, lies to them, and I'm going to come back to that in just a minute, as you can see in your handout. But then she said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. Now, that's actually something that's also said in the book of Numbers. But here now, a non-believer, a non-Jew, is saying the same thing Joshua has said before. And the reason they are having this kind of sense of fear is no doubt they heard, first of all, about God parting the Red Sea and the destruction of the Egyptian army. Can you not think that that would have spread pretty quickly? I mean, this major military force, when the Egyptians lose so many men there at the Red Sea, this obviously made its way onto the caravans, and as the caravans made their way into Jericho, they're saying, you can't believe what has happened. You know, the army of Egypt has been decimated because of these individuals, these slaves that left and crossed over in dry land, but they were killed and drowned in the Red Sea. And then, if that's not enough, then they also heard from Shittim about what would happen there. And so as a result, you can begin to see that they are fearful. And here we see in Joshua 2:11, as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted. There was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is the God in the heavens above and the earth beneath. So even though she is a Canaanite, which had a horrible and despicable culture. I'm going to talk about that in a few weeks, because one of the questions that I get from you is, well, how do we justify some of the killing that takes place, including Jericho and some of these other places? We'll learn a little bit more about what it was like to be part of the Canaanite culture, where infant sacrifice and human sacrifice was taking place and all sorts of decadence. But in the midst of this, she recognizes who the real true God is. Not the God of the Canaanites, but it's Yahweh, the God of Israel. And so again, this is essentially the same argument that Joshua makes in Numbers 14. And now we see that he is saying the same thing as she, or put it more bluntly, she is agreeing with the same kind of assessment that Joshua has. And so as a result, the people of Jericho are afraid not because of Israel. In some respects, they're afraid because they recognize that they are going to be fighting God. To put it bluntly, some of the people in Jericho were more believers in the power of God than those 10 spies that we read about in Numbers who came back and did not believe in the power of God. And so now the whole community has heard of these miracles that God has done, and as a result they knew that God indeed was the true God. But as far as we know, only Rahab and her household were saved from that destruction. So let's work our way through the rest of this passage, and then we'll have some application points, starting in verse 12. Here she's talking to the man, and she says, "Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sister, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." And the men said to her, "Our life or yours, even in death. For if you did not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built on the city wall. That would be that outer city wall, so that they lived in the wall. And she said to them, "Go into the hills, or the pursuers will encounter you, and hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Then afterwards you may go your way." The men said to her, "We will be guiltless with respect to our oath of yours that you have made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, you shall tie this scarlet cord in the window through which you let down, and you will gather into your house your father and mother, your brothers, and all of your father's household. Then if anyone goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be guiltless." In other words, we don't know who that is, so we'll strike him down. "But if the hand is laid on anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be guiltless with respect to your oath that you have made us swear." Kind of like he's a lawyer. He's got every contingency figured out, doesn't he, here? And he said, "According to your word, so be it." Then she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and went into the hills and remained there for 3 days until the pursuers returned, and the pursuers searched all along the way and found nothing. Then the two men returned. They came down from the hills and passed over, came to Joshua the son of Nun, and they told him all that had happened to them. And they said to Joshua, "Truly the Lord has given all the land into your hands, and also all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of us." So here we once again see some of the implications here as well. Before God brought down the walls of Jericho, he brought down the stronghold that may have been binding Rahab. So we see not only a physical action, but a spiritual action as well. Her confession, I think, to the spies actually shows that she had an understanding of who Yahweh is and how he was at work. And so even though she is a Canaanite, through her conviction, now she becomes part of Israel. And we're going to tell the rest of the story in just a minute in terms of the heritage. But it's interesting because she sort of reminds us and reminds the readers reading this about the fact that sometimes God uses outsiders. You know, they are separated from God. They were alienated from Israel, strangers to the covenant of promise. But nevertheless, we see that indeed God uses those outsiders. And if you're taking some notes, you might put this in the margin of your handout there. I put down Ephesians 2:12 because in some respects, before we became Christians, we were all outsiders. Now, Jared Stevens said he became a Christian at the age of 11. Maybe that's because of that snake that fell in the water and he had to walk in the water. I don't know. But nevertheless, you know, some of us were only outsiders for a short period of time. Some of us were outsiders for a long period of time. But what does Paul say in Ephesians? "Remember that you were at that time separated from God, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope without God in the world." And so I think it's kind of interesting that that in some respects, all of us at one time or another have been outsiders. And yet here we see that God brings down this wall of separation between us. And really, it's a declaration of indeed a faith that brings salvation to an outsider. And so even as we look at Rahab here, we can see that she was brought near by her declaration that God to the God of Israel. And it certainly we see that her faith was evident not just in word, but also in deed. We're going to see James quotes from her quite a bit and uses her as an illustration in just a minute. So we see that through her confession, she also is willing to serve. She is going to return to her family. Verse 14, of course, shows the oath, an oath of protection. And then, of course, she lowers them out over the window and sends them to these limestone caves, which are about a half a mile to the west. If you ever go to Jericho, you can actually see where Jericho is. Now, there's the modern city of Jericho, but the ruins are still there. And you can see how it's about 14 miles from Jordan River. And you can actually go up and you see some of those limestone caves. Matter of fact, if you've ever been on a tour, even if they don't take you there, lots of times they take you to the caves in En Gedi, which is where David hid and actually cut off part of the robe of Saul. So you can actually go into some of those caves and see what it was like. And so they spend 3 days in the caves, which is a pretty safe place because most people do not go into the caves because there's usually other things, not humans, sometimes in those caves. So if you're there, very rarely do people go into those. And so they were able to be completely undetected while they spend their time in those caves. And then eventually we see the result of that. And that is that indeed they're saved. And as I mentioned, James, the half-brother of Jesus, when he is talking about the importance of having works with our faith, we're not saved by our works, but those of us that have faith should have works. He uses a lot of examples, and one of those, interestingly enough, is he reaches all the way back to Joshua chapter 2 to illustrate that. And he says, in the same way, was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when he received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead. Most of us have memorized that part, you know, faith without works is dead and the body without the spirit is dead. But the verses before that use Rahab as an object lesson. So Rahab shows up in the Hebrew Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11. Rahab shows up again in James chapter 2 as James trying to illustrate that. That's pretty good for a Canaanite prostitute, don't you think? And I think it illustrates again that if God can use her, God can certainly use you. One question that always certainly surfaced there is, what's the significance of the scarlet cord? You know, and some try to make it, an illustration of Jesus. You know, John Bunyan and others, you know, sometimes read Jesus into every chapter of the Old Testament. I think that's a little bit of a stretch, but maybe it is. But certainly I think it relates to something else. Then in the Old Testament, in Genesis 38, a scarlet cord was actually tied around the waist of one of Tamar's twin children, I think in part to distinguish them. My brother and sister-in-law had identical twin daughters. And Sarah and Julie were so identical that even mom sometimes had trouble telling them apart because they were so identical. It's one thing for dad not to be able to, but when mom has a little difficulty, you know, they had to use some little tricks just to kind of keep them separated a little bit. So we see that. And of course, also when we think about the blood, you know, the scarlet cord, you know, the blood on the lintel and also on the sides, you know, making the sign of the cross. So maybe some people believe there is some significance there. But ultimately, we see now that the victory is ultimately spiritual. You know, God authors every detail, as we're going to look at in the next couple of weeks. And it is, again, one of those places where you have to exercise faith in the midst of what had to be almost foolishness. You can imagine some of the people in Jericho looking out and watching people rotate, you know, walking around and blowing a shofar and things like that, going, what in the world is going on? If you're in the parade, you must have really wondered what was going on. But nevertheless, we'll see that again, God is showing that he is going to bring about the victory, just as he did with Gideon and so many others. And so again, the plan there is for them to actually be saved. And of course, he is the one that affirmed her faith by salvaging the wall where that house remained intact. The other walls fall down, but that part of the wall stays up. And so, again, we'll look at that in a couple of weeks. We're also, of course, part of that undercover agreement. You know, it's the desire that God would rescue every outsider. I just used that a minute ago. And again, this is a narrative where we see, I think, God welcomes all individuals. Outsiders, sinners, saved by grace. And of course, the oath that is given there, sometimes again illustrates that. But I think it's important to recognize that when we're talking about outsiders, sometimes those of us that are insiders, we have a little bit of trouble with the outsiders, don't we? You know, if you come into church, you look around and go, can I help you? Are you going to be in this class? Are you going to be in this church? But, you know, we have to recognize all of us were outsiders, and sometimes it's insiders that have a little difficulty with outsiders. So I thought I'd put up Titus, because here, as Paul is writing, he says, "For we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures. But when the goodness and loving kindness of God our Savior appeared, he saved us not because of works done by us in righteousness, but according to what? His own mercy. We were saved by grace." So sometimes we need to be maybe a little less judgmental about outsiders, because there was a time, you know, when we were outsiders as well. Well, finally, we'll finish this off and get into some of the questions and application. The spies stayed there for 3 days in the cave. You got to hope that they had some food with them. Otherwise, it's a little bleak in a cave. But nevertheless, they stay there for 3 days. And they come back to Joshua. And what do they report? Indeed, that their hearts melted in fear. And so God not only saves Rahab, but uses Rahab. Because as I shared in my email to you this week, Rahab was given by God a husband, because she was a prostitute for the time. But then eventually God gives Rahab the husband, Salmon. And Salmon has a son by the name of what? Boaz. And Boaz has a great-grandson by the name of David. Isn't that amazing? Just a fascinating thing. And so again, Rahab shows up on the genealogy in the book of Matthew. So there's three different places. She shows up in Hebrews 11, she shows up in James 2, and she shows up in Matthew 1. And if that doesn't, you know, light your fire, your wood is wet. I think that's pretty amazing stuff. And I think it illustrates only so well that if indeed God can use Rahab, he can use you. A couple of quick points. Questions to consider. First of all, some people said, okay, what about the faith of Rahab? You know, for all the negative beginnings, you see that, as I said, she rises as a star in the midst of biblical history. She makes, as I said, the Hebrew Hall of Faith that says here, by faith, prostitute Rahab became, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. And as I mentioned in James 2, was not Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? So we can see certainly that God places his seal of approval upon her. And what a contrast if you think about that, because if you go back to Hebrews 11, it talks about Abraham, and then it talks about Rahab in really just a few verses separated from each other. And you have Abraham, who was a man of position, of prominence, of exemplary character. He has a few falls along the way. And you have Rahab, who comes from a point of degradation, a Canaanite, a prostitute, a person of insignificance, and yet both of them are given prominence within the Hebrew Hall of Faith. I think it's kind of interesting. And so James, even in James 2, does the contrasting as well between those two individuals, and again demonstrates their righteousness and talks about the need for us to have those deeds. Here's something else in terms of her act of faithfulness. You go back and look at Rahab. If you look at that genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1, we actually have her and four other women, five women in total. The only woman that is mentioned of those five that are mentioned in the genealogy that's a Jew is who? His mother, Mary. All the other four are what? They're non-Jews. You think about that. Tamar, Ruth, Bathsheba, and of course Rahab. And so again, I think it even illustrates kind of the inclusiveness of the Abrahamic covenant, something that Paul talks about in the book of Romans, that the gospel and even the covenant was not just for the Jews, it's for the Gentiles as well. And here we can see that she actually is numbered among other, if you will, Gentile, pagan women who are in that genealogy that leads up to Jesus. Pretty fascinating. Okay, the most controversial part is, what about Rahab? She lied, didn't she? What about this? Okay, I have whole sections, and we have discussions sometimes when I teach at a Bible college or a seminary about this. And we recognize that, first of all, the Bible contemns lying. So as a result, and the Bible says that God himself cannot lie, so does the Bible condone what Rahab did? Here's a place where you have a little bit of intramural discussion. You have many individuals, for example, people like Dr. Norm Geisler and others that talk about kind of graded hierarchicalism. In other words, if indeed your goal is to save a life, you can certainly justify a lower sin, if you will, and that is lying. And so there have been some that have said this would be permissible because your goal is to save a life. It's the Corrie Ten Boom question, isn't it? It is, well, okay, if they knock at your door and say, do you have any Jews in your house? Are you permitted to say no, or do you have to say, nope, they're in the attic? Think about that for a minute. Now, and there were some who actually saved Jews who did lie. And some people say, well, that seems a little bit strange. We should never be deceptive. You ever played basketball? Ever played football? You know, of course, you know, when I take my basketball and go like this and then go like that, I'm faking people out, theoretically, you know, or, you know, when you're playing football and, you know, you pretend to hand it off and then you pass, you know, certainly all sorts of things. If you think that this is small, it becomes very large, because when Suzanne and I lived in Washington, D.C., when I was at Georgetown, I taught a Sunday school class. A good number of the people in the Sunday school class work for the CIA. These are Christians that work for the CIA. Now think about this for just a minute. They had to think very carefully about how they dealt with this issue of deception and lying. Many of them had desk jobs, but anybody that went out on the field, or even individuals that were putting out policy papers or disinformation, had to really think that through. So it's no small issue indeed. There are others, of course, that call for the idea of non-conflicting absolutes. There are all sorts of people, many of whom teach it. Moody Bible Institute, Erwin Lutzer would be an example of that, which would say that there is never a time in which a lower sin can be justified, even if you're going to save a life. And so, indeed, those are individuals that think about this a little differently. One of the former secretaries at Probe Ministries used to work with Brother Andrew. You know what Brother Andrew used to do? He would actually smuggle Bibles into the Soviet Union. And they had the philosophy that whenever they were asked a direct question, they would give a direct answer. So when they were asked, are you bringing Bibles into the Iron Curtain? They would say yes. And because they said yes, they just never believed them, and they were able to get the Bibles in there. Interestingly enough. Now, she also pointed out sometimes Brother Andrew asked her to dress a little more provocatively, and so they were so busy looking at her, they weren't even necessarily asking the question. And so that's another way in which individuals have responded to this as well. But even if it is, if indeed you believe that was a sin, certainly God forgave her because she shows up in that. But the point is, many times the Bible reports what the Bible does not condone. The Bible reports all sorts of things, like David's sin with Bathsheba. It reports all sorts of wickedness and evil, but doesn't mean necessarily that the Bible condones it. So I think either way, we can certainly move beyond that issue. But again, it was a lie that was used by Rahab to save those spies. Finally, some application points you can see in your handout real quickly. The first one is that I put down this idea that God, we can rest because God is with you. We can learn some vicarious lessons from these individuals. The same God that encouraged Joshua, emboldened the spies, enlightened Rahab, and provided victory for Israel is what? The same God that indeed has promised to always be with his children. That's you. And so as Jesus tasked even his disciples to go into this lost world, he also reminded them that in the face of that challenge, he would never leave them. So one of the things I think we can learn is that we can rest because we recognize that God is with us. You know, Jesus walked the disciples through the wonderful moments, and he walked with them through his birth and the healing and all sorts of other things. But then he also saw them through the darkest hours, even when they were in the midst of doubt, walking on the water and in the midst of a storm. And here you can see again that in victory and agony, you are secure. He has not forgotten you, and he has a plan. So the first thing I think we can apply here is that the same God that provided a victory for the Israelites and protected the spies is the same God that can protect you as well. The second is to give. You know, give God your plans. We recognize that if we were to look at the human perspective of Jericho, it is an impenetrable fortress that cannot be brought down. And so sometimes we have to give plans to God, and he can see things that we cannot see. I put down there Psalm 37, verses 23 to 24. Here, God will arrange the steps of those. You can put down Proverbs 19 and other passages that all talk about God directing your steps. And so when a plan changes, you can rest knowing that God will still encourage you, and that we need to simply walk in obedience, and he will direct us. Instead of worrying about tomorrow, I put down again, you know, don't worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow has enough worries for today. Focus on today. And again, God has called you today. And believers are not promised a problem-free or danger-free set of lives. John 16:33 actually said that there are going to be struggles that we're going to face, but he has promised his provision in the midst of that. And so again, we can certainly give. And finally, we can redeem. Never underestimate the power of God to redeem. You know, Jesus gave his life for the lost, the downtrodden in society are not too far gone. And as we, I think, have learned today, if God can use Rahab, he can certainly use you, and certainly he did. When encountering those who have been discarded by the world, look for opportunity to share mercy with those around, and I think God desires to bring outsiders to him. So I hope that is, if nothing else, an encouragement as we go through a very familiar story. Next week, we will look at the crossing of the Jordan River. We'll talk about whether that was an earthquake, and if it was, it certainly happened at a perfect coincidence to allow a million-plus people to cross across it, and then we'll continue our work through the book of Joshua. Yesterday, I was at this call. It is called United Call DC. Oh, there we go. It's not. There we go. That's where I need to be. United Call DC 16. And this was something that was put forward to actually call the nation to prayer. Now, it's just one of many prayer events. I might just mention that the first Thursday in May is our National Day of Prayer. Last year, of course, we've talked about the individual who was the honorary chairman, Jack Graham. This year, the honorary chairman is Tony Evans, and we're all going to be going to a banquet for him Thursday night. He's going to be receiving a very special award as well. And at this event, I got to meet many of the other people involved in various prayer ministries. And we are noticing something. There's a couple of themes that come from this real quickly, and then I'll turn it back over to Parker because I know we have to show a video. But one of the themes that certainly surfaced time and again is more of God's people are praying than ever before. You know, it is pretty amazing that I'm talking 1 minute to somebody who works with Shirley Dobson in Colorado Springs with the National Prayer Ministry. Then I talk to someone else who has this huge prayer ministry I've never even heard of before. And then I'm talking to someone else who's a prayer warrior who's there, and I'm talking to other individuals who are involved in the pro-life movement, and they're just bathing all the things they're doing in abortion right now with prayer. And then when I'm with Alvita, why did I just blank on names here? Alvita King, Dr. Alvita King, and she is the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King. And as a result, talking about all the prayers going into what is happening right now in racial reconciliation, I'm talking with Bishop Harry Jackson, who's one of the individuals up there, talking about all the prayers happening there. And so one of the themes is we're seeing an increased amount of prayer for this nation. That's got to be good news. I mean, it used to be that if you said, we're going to have a prayer meeting Wednesday night at the church, nobody shows up, or five people show up. You know how that goes. Well, we've all been down that road. But this is changing rather dramatically. This was a call to bring thousands of pastors and Christian leaders there. It's kind of a who's who. You can see some of those there. And Graham Watts, Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, Bishop Harry Jackson, to mention just a few. So that was one very important theme. Another one was this. Over on the left-hand side, that is Lewis Hogan. He is the man who actually brought this about. Now, this fits perfectly with our theme because, you know, Lewis Hogan is kind of like Clark Kent's shy brother. I mean, I've gotten to know Lewis pretty well, and his wife, she's, you know, actually just a fifth grade English teacher in the public schools. And frankly, if Lewis and his wife were in this church, maybe even in this class, it'd probably be a month or two before EJ or Parker would even think of inviting them to be on a committee. This is the guy that brought this about, you know. Again, it just illustrates God. Now, you really have some really incredible individuals. I got a picture there of Ann Graham Watts. I guess you'll see that in just a minute. And some really gifted speakers. But, you know, you meet some other individuals, and he's one of them where you just go, this is amazing. He just has the faith to believe in God. But, you know, in terms of leadership skills and everything, wonderful man. But, you know, he wouldn't be the guy that you'd pick to be your leader of your Sunday school class or of your small group or anything like that. And yet here he is speaking. And here on the right-hand side there, you can see this probably a little better on your screens there, but these were all the African-Americans that were there. That was powerful for all the issues of racial reconciliation, calling for God to forgive our land for slavery and then for discrimination and things of that nature. But again, most of the time you see these people with their heads bowed. And then go over there. This was Ann Graham Watts. I didn't want to interrupt her, but she spent a lot of time in the scriptures just reading and those kinds of things. And then again, this was another theme that began to surface, not only just the ethnic diversity, black, white, you know, yellow, red in his sight, and all those kinds of things, but also the incredible denominational diversity. I mean, one minute, I'm talking with Ronnie Floyd. He is the head of the Southern Baptist Convention this year. Jeff Young, matter of fact, came from his church. As a matter of fact, we were talking about Jeff Young and what's going on here at Preston and everything. The next minute, I'm talking to the head of the General Assembly of the Assemblies of God. You know, I'm talking to people from all sorts of different denominations, and whereas before, you know, you couldn't get two Baptists in the same room if they maybe disagreed on one theological point. You're with me on this? And now you're getting people joining hands together, and it's just kind of an ecumenical outpouring. And so if nothing else, I've just seen some really encouraging signs. You know, if you look at the world right now, you can be really discouraged. You know, if you look horizontally, you can get really depressed. But if you look vertically, you can be blessed. And so, again, out there in the midst of some of the coldest weather I've had to endure for some time, you know, with winds blowing, and we had to take the speakers down because we're afraid they might fall down on people. And they put me in this little tent, but that didn't do any good because it's flapping the whole time and knocking us and everything. Every once in a while, I'd just go in the Lincoln Memorial, just try to warm up enough so that my mouth would work because you couldn't talk after a while. You get so cold. It was quite an experience. But even if it was cold outside, it was warm in the hearts because I think it illustrates what God is doing. And so they were doing a simulcast with also the event that was taking place in Los Angeles. And there are more and more of these very important solemn assemblies. As a matter of fact, Tony Evans, who I mentioned just a minute ago, has a very significant solemn assembly that's coming here in September. And so it's going to be, I think, the year of prayer here in 2016. And like I said, if that doesn't encourage you, I don't know what else I can say. Parker?